Great trial lawyers are made, not born. Welcome to Verdict Academy, preserving trial wisdom for trial lawyers. Join host Kevin Morrison, trial attorney in San Francisco, as he recreates those invaluable hallway conversations that remote work has made rare. Candid insights and hard-won lessons from America's most accomplished trial lawyers. Produced and powered by Law Pods.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Verdict Academy. You know, for my career, I've always loved trial and thought of it as an art with some science involved. And in the 30 years plus that my career has been going here, I've been trying to introduce more and more science to my cases. I think it's very interesting. Well, our next guest is a leader in blending rigorous academic research with real-world trial strategy, which unlocks the secrets of how and why jurors decide cases. Please welcome John Campbell to our podcast. John is a trial lawyer and trial scientist. He was born and raised in Texas, a little north of Dallas, back when that was a rural area. He met his wife, Alicia, in college, and after they married, they moved to Missouri, where they both taught high school. And because that wasn't busy enough, they decided to go to night law school while they taught high school. After John got his law degree, he worked at the John Simon Law Firm in St. Louis. As some of you know, John is a pioneer in plaintiff's trial work. He's a member of Inner Circle, Oboda, American College. When John Campbell was there, he tried numerous plaintiff cases to verdict. However, he also joined his wife's firm, Alicia Campbell Law Firm. But the teaching bug never really left John, so he went on to teach at University of Denver School of Law, where he taught law school, basically, and then would fly to St. Louis and do cases because he likes to stay busy. Together, John and Alicia have been lead counsel in a dozen cases across the country. John is a pioneer in the area of big data, which means having 300 or 400 jurors study a case and come to a verdict. John and his wife, Alicia Campbell, have gone to study over 1,350 civil cases. They studied more jurors than anyone on earth, over 400,000 jurors. He's authored multiple peer-reviewed studies and is co-author of Jury Ball, which is an easy-to-read book on what big data is and how to make it apply to your cases. John Campbell, it is my honor and pleasure to have you be a guest on Verdict Academy. Welcome, my friend.
Hi, Kevin. Thanks so much for having me. Congrats on the podcast. I'm really excited about this one. I love the format.
Thanks. I appreciate it. As you know, the format is 3 trial tips to offer less experienced trial attorneys, and we'll do that shortly. But let me ask you a question generally. What big data is, but tell us, you're the expert. What is big data in this context?
Sure. You know, big data means different things in different contexts, as you suggested. If we were in data mining to figure out what, you know, people consume or what advertisements to show them, we might be talking about billions of data points. But in law, where traditional study of jury behavior was 10 or 12 people in a focus group, big data is more often 300 or 400 people looking at a case. Although we do run studies privately for attorneys that have gone up to 1,200 jurors and academic studies that have exceeded 2,000 jurors. So they're pretty big samples. And the core idea of doing big data empirical studies in the civil setting is that if we show a true and accurate, distilled, of course, case presentation of the plaintiff's case and defense case to a large enough sample of people in a way that they can process it and pay attention, and we make sure they're doing that, we can learn a lot of things about what's likely to occur in that case and why they're occurring. We can learn a lot about what types of people respond differently to that case, either more favorably for the plaintiff or less. And we can also do things like experimental manipulations where different groups of people see different versions of that case, whether we alter evidence or a damage ask or a jury instruction. And because we have big samples, we can know with some certainty whether that variable, when changed, made a difference. And so with that, we can infuse a lot more precision into understanding what's likely to occur in cases, what is the best strategy for the attorney who's studying the case, and why jurors are doing what they're doing. That's it in a nutshell.
Got it. And so when I was starting out, when I got into introducing science into the art of trial, I would do some focus groups, meaning I would have 12 or 25 people listen to a case. We'd present the plaintiff's side, the defense side, show them evidence and argue it. And they'd deliberate for an hour, 2 hours of the verdict form. And after 5 hours or 8 hours, whatever it was, you get 12, 24, or 36 jurors of their opinions, right? That's, I'm sure you've done those as well early on. And so that was super helpful. I love them. I still do them under certain circumstances. But my jury consultant told me, hey, these are not predictive of results in cases because the sample size is too small. They're helpful because they'll identify issues. They'll help you hone your themes, but they're not predictive. So my understanding, John, is that big data helps move it from move it a little more to the predictive side. If you study 300 or 400 people with a rigorous vetting of who these people are and making sure they actually pay attention, the outcome, the results of these data is much more predictive for the lawyers. Is that accurate?
That's exactly right. I mean, essentially you're solving a couple of problems if you do larger sample empirical studies well. The first is the small numbers problem, which we all know intuitively, whether you're a statistician or not. You can imagine if you flip a coin 10 times, you could get heads 8 times. That's not because the probability of getting heads is 80%. It's because it was a small sample. If we flipped it 300 times, we might get 51% or 49%, but we would not get 80% in a true coin. So we solve the problem with a larger sample. That's what we're doing with more people. The second part, which you touched on too, is that when all of us do in-person focus groups, they're beyond the small sample issue. There's also the issue that there are real challenges in evenly weighting that, in making sure that no one knows who's doing that study, in making sure everyone is paying attention, and making sure that people feel comfortable sharing candid responses when they've only known each other for an hour or two in a room. And so most of us who've ever done that on our own cases know sometimes what you end up with is 3 people talking a lot and 9 people sitting very quietly and you trying to coach information out of them. What we've learned over time is online studies can be rigorously built. We can pilot them and make sure that people can't guess who sponsored them. People are more candid online. In our case, we use Cornell professors to build our studies and analyze our data, which means that even if I was putting my thumb on the scale unintentionally, they're likely to notice it. And so I think really the empirical method, big data studies, solves the small number problem. But over time, we've also realized it solves some of the stimulus problem, to put it in, you know, statistical or study terms. It means that we show a better stimulus, a better case presentation. We control better what the jurors are thinking about that. And then we also get a more candid response from the people who then take that study.
Amazing. I'm just fascinated by this topic. Well, let's move to the meat of the podcast. As you know, we would like to give 3 top tips for trial lawyers. And because you've got so much experience in studying jury behavior and you're a trial lawyer yourself, you bring unique perspective to this. So the 3 things I think you want to talk about are credibility, personality, and stereotypes. So let's start with 1, credibility. Talk to us about credibility in trial, John.
Sure. Credibility is an interesting topic to me because it is sort of a double-edged sword. We all know that as lawyers, when we walk into court, at least with some subset of jurors, we are not perceived as credible. We're lawyers. You know, all the lawyer jokes and lawyer's a liar and all these things are in jurors' heads. So I see that as an opportunity. I think it was a Shakespearean play in which they said the sun shines brighter after a cloudy day. And so I say to lawyers, look, you don't start with a lot of credibility currency, but you can earn it throughout the case by being credible. This isn't a show. This isn't a dance. But if you are credible in jury selection, if you are credible in opening statement, if your experts are credible, if your life care plan is credible, if your positions are credible, if you don't attack the plaintiff or defendant, depending on what side you're on, unnecessarily or unfairly, if you concede the things you should, by the end, you could have jurors saying, you know, this attorney and this case is really credible. And they're really, I feel like they've been really straight with me. And if that happens, that credibility currency sort of infuses and matters in all the close calls in the case. And so to me, I'm always worried if an attorney, a plaintiff's attorney, for example, says to me, oh, I love it. I've got a $120 million life care plan. And when I look at it, 80% of the stuff that's in that life care plan is stuff the plaintiff isn't getting and hasn't had for 5 years and probably doesn't need. And they're like, yeah, but it's a big number. Because what we know is jurors are sophisticated and they're careful and they're smart. And they will look at that thing. And especially when the defense tears it apart, they'll say, you're not being honest with me. Well, that attorney's just done what the jurors expected, damaged their credibility. And so the result is when they talk to the jury about things like damages or fault, the jury is less likely to take them seriously. They view that attorney as then negotiating with them, probably spinning it. And so it's interesting to me that when we study cases, we measure the win rate and fault and damages and all sorts of things. We have thousands of measures in many studies. But the one that I often look at is when we ask jurors to rate how credible the plaintiff and defense case are. If we see that the plaintiff is only as credible as the defense or less, that is a red flag for me that the plaintiff, regardless of win rate, is in danger. Because, of course, the plaintiff has the burden of proof. And if the plaintiff is putting on a case that is no more credible than the defense's position, the plaintiff usually has a problem. And if the defense is more credible than the plaintiff, over those 1,300 cases we've talked about, we've never seen a plaintiff verdict. So to me, for young lawyers, there's this idea you should fight every point, sell every idea, never give in. I would say that's not true at all. I would say take reasonable, honest positions. If you have a 24-year-old who's been hurt badly, but their mind is good, don't say they can never work again and model their damages for lost wages for the rest of their life. People know people work in wheelchairs. People know people work with back pain. How about you model their damages what's realistic, which is they might have some diminished capacity to work. They might miss some days. They might lose some jobs. There's some jobs they can't get. You'll give up a little on economic damages as a plaintiff's lawyer, but you'll get it back fivefold in credibility. And that currency will run throughout the case. So young lawyer tip one would be avoid this idea you must fight everything and that your job, since it's adversarial, to take the most extreme positions for your client. It hurts your client to do so. There's room in court to be candid, honest, and clear, and jurors will reward that.
It's so fascinating to me because I was always taught early on that the three most important things in trial are credibility, credibility, and credibility. And you've studied that. So how does a big data study, which does not show any videos of the lawyers, the jurors in trial, right? You think to see how we drink water, how we treat people, how we treat our staff, how we treat the clerk. That's important, right? There's none of that in a big data study. How the heck does a big data juror know that someone's credible or not? By the arguments, by the evidence?
Yeah, it's the positions taken. So, I mean, think of a few things that could happen. You know, a plaintiff's lawyer comes in. Their client has grossly missed you. Let's say that they were driving a car. No, let's say they were using an ATV. They were drunk. They were driving too fast. And then they come in and say, this ATV is defective. You know, it doesn't brake right or the roof doesn't work right or whatever. And so the defendant's liable for making a bad product. And they never once say, well, my client was also driving too fast and drinking. And he or she can and does accept whatever responsibility you believe they have. You have a right to give them fault. And in fact, folks, I'm here to tell you, you should. Now, that would be a credible position. Well, you don't need, that's not the attorney's personality. That's a position taken in the case, which we'll see in the presentation. You know, we talked about the life care plan. I mentioned lost wages, modeling lost wages, where a person who never went to college is suddenly going to be a doctor and they lost 50 years of income as a medical doctor. And you give the jurors no other options. And the jury thinks, maybe they would have done that, but it sure would have helped me to see a range of possible lost earnings. All these sorts of things, the factual positions are often what impacts credibility most. Because the lawyer can seem very honest and sincere, and they can use all sorts of words about candor. But if their case isn't candid, jurors will look at the facts and say, this case overall, not the attorney in particular, this case overall is not credible. And that's toxic on either side.
Yeah. 100% agree with that. And as a practicing trial lawyer, I can tell you that when I stand up and accept responsibility for something, I need to accept responsibility for it. Literally, you can feel it take the air out of the room. The anger goes down like five notches. Oh, he's admitting the obvious. Why are we here? Well, we're here because they don't accept. And so, okay, I don't have to deal with this, right? It's amazing. You feel it.
Yeah, well, and you know, you change the terrain of deliberation too, because another thing I talk to about young lawyers is, look, where are the jurors going to spend their time? If there's a fight about whether your client has comparative fault, and when we study it, we see that 70% of people believe your client does. If you walk into court and say your client doesn't, you take a position that we know now 7 out of 10 people will disagree with, guess what deliberation's about? It's about why you didn't accept it and whether your client has fault, and the jury spends 3 hours on comparative. Well, for a plaintiff's attorney, the jury spending most of its time talking about your client's fault isn't a good place to start, because it's going to bleed over into liability and damages, right? And so I also think of it as, when you're credible about issues, you remove that issue from the work the jury does and you let them get to the things you want them working on.
Yeah, fascinating. All right. Point two, personality. Talk to us about what personality matters, how it affects jury decision-making, again, in the context of you studying so much data where the lawyer's personality isn't injected in those studies. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, the headline here is, for young lawyers, is that personality, meaning the lawyer's personality, is a very small explanatory variable. Meaning, if we look at all the things that impact outcome in a case, the personality of the lawyer is one of the smallest explanatory pieces. Doesn't mean it has no importance, but that importance is very small compared to things like strength of evidence, right? Which across all studies, private and academic, is the primary predictor of case outcome, as it should be, right? We don't actually want jurors to decide cases on whether or not the lawyer was funny or good looking or charming or had a deep voice or whatever, right? That's not actually what we want jurors deciding cases on. And here's the good news. Across every academic study ever looking at this and across our own, jurors don't do that. They decide cases based on the facts. So what does that mean for a young lawyer? It means you need to be competent in the rules of evidence. You need to be organized and prepared. You need to get the evidence in that matters to your case. Are you going to lose the case because you said a few times, because you couldn't find the document on the podium a couple of times and had to spend 30 seconds looking for it? No. Are you going to lose the case because the other side really was eloquent and kind of funny and you're a little plain? No. The answer is no. And I can tell you that we know this in a few ways, very briefly. One, we study cases for lawyers all over the country. And I know most of them personally. Like, I know you, Kevin, and many other good lawyers across the country. They all have really different personalities. I mean, if you look at sort of trial stars across the country, there are people who are flamboyant. There are people who are sort of quiet and reserved. There are people who are sort of big and calm and confident, but not particularly eloquent. There's everything in between. Many, many of those plaintiff's lawyers, those are who I work with, as great defense lawyers too, have wonderful verdicts for their clients, but they don't do it the same way. What they all have in common, because I get to work with them, is that they prepare, think through evidence, litigate carefully to get the evidence, file good motions in limine, get their witnesses there on time, prepare those witnesses, right? All those sorts of things. And we know that over the last 1,300 cases, many of which have gone to trial, the ability to predict what the likely outcome has not been dependent on who the lawyer was. We have been able to predict outcomes accurately, regardless of attorney personality and without studying it, which confirms for us over time what the literature was telling us, that personality is not a primary driving factor. Now, I don't like to overstate things. So it is absolutely true that if a case is a coin toss and it's really tight, and the jury ends up thinking the plaintiff's attorney was credible and likable, and their client is credible and likable, it could matter in parts of the brain that process information. Nobody's saying it doesn't matter at all. But in the grand scheme of things, it is a very small percentage of sort of how we explain what juries do.
Fascinating. I think this is so important for less experienced attorneys, because you have to be yourself. And when you're yourself, you know, you can't play lawyer man or lawyer woman or model yourself after whoever your hero is. That never works. You're always a poor copy of somebody else. And there's so many people that say, you know what, this person's successful. I'm going to copy his or her methods. I'm going to be like him or her. I tried that a couple of times. It does not work because you can't pull it off. You got to be you. And once you're comfortable in your own skin and you understand that you, as ineloquent as you may be or whatever it is, as long as you work your tail off, know the evidence and care about that client, you're going to have as good a result as anybody else in that case. And that's such a great takeaway and it's great words of encouragement for younger folks who are afraid to get in the courtroom and try cases.
Absolutely. Kevin, I would just give you one example of like not a person, maybe it's examples. I can tell you that we have a number of cases with lawyers you've never heard of, with varying ranges of comfortableness in courtrooms, who worked up the case carefully, prepared like crazy, got everything ready, studied the case multiple times, knew what jurors needed, wanted, got lost on, could be confused by, took credible positions, and then went in and tried that case. In some cases, I was in the courtroom. I've seen it on CVN. I've read the transcripts. They weren't always pretty. It wasn't always eloquent. And they got good verdicts for their client in line with the data because ultimately they put the evidence in front of the jurors. And jurors, again, don't go back in deliberation and say, I don't think the plaintiff proved their case, and I don't think they're as hurt as they say, but the lawyer is so funny that it doesn't happen.
Yeah. Fascinating. Okay. Third tip you want to share with our folks, stereotypes. Tell me about stereotypes, John.
Yeah, when I'm thinking of stereotypes, there's lots of ways we could talk about that, but I'm thinking about the sort of idea of stereotypes in jury selection. Because depending on where you were trying cases as a young lawyer, you were probably taught different wives' tales or sort of myths of what kind of jurors you want. And I think one of the most common is defense attorneys believe they want conservative jurors. And plaintiff attorneys politically conservative jurors, and plaintiff attorneys want politically liberal jurors. You know, is that true sometimes? Absolutely. Is that true in every case we study? Not even close. When we study these cases, you know, much like political polling, after the verdict comes, you know, after we have everybody vote and we know who wins and loses and the percentages, we can look backward and ask a simple statistical question. Hey, did any traits of people predict how they would vote in a statistically significant way? And we could know if different age groups vote differently or different political stripes or different income levels or whatever. And we look at political orientation, both as registered Republican, registered Democrat, Green Party, whatever, and self-identified. I'm a self-identified conservative fiscally or socially. And we ask those things. And in many, many cases, it has no predictive value at all. There are cases in which it does, but what's interesting is that every once in a while, even if you were to say, on average, sometimes politically conservative people are slightly less valuable to a plaintiff's case than a liberal juror, every few cases it'll invert. And it could invert because the case plaintiff identity changes. You can imagine a plaintiff that through the course of trial, jurors will begin to decide is very conservative. For any number of reasons that could come in, or they decide that, or they recognize that the plaintiff is a police officer or a soldier or whatever. In those settings, we can see the traditional predictors of good and bad jurors for plaintiff and defense invert. And so to me, it's been a good reminder that people are complex, that these sort of stereotypical rule of thumb heuristics that we use to think of people break down. I'll flag it, the academic literature and our own studies confirm too that the ideas that race, the race of people might predict how they vote is simply untrue. The idea that gender is some sort of common predictor is untrue. Doesn't mean those things couldn't mean something in some study or some case. There's academic literature where men and women have acted differently, for example, but it is not true across cases they act differently in the same ways. And it is true in many cases they don't act differently at all. And so my last, you know, sort of tip for a young lawyer who's trying cases would be put that stuff aside. Treat jurors as individuals, as complex individuals. ask general questions about their views of the legal system, if allowed, and ask specific questions about their views of the parties and issues in your case. That will tell you far more about whether there is some deep-seated feeling or bias that could prejudice your client. Since most jury selection is deselection, you're really looking for the people that hold some view deeply enough that maybe they won't be able to hear the evidence for your side. You'll learn a lot more talking to them about the system and their views on lawsuits and their views in your particular case than you'll ever learn relying on these sort of heuristic views about demographic characteristics.
Yeah, let me amplify on that if I can. And I can because it's my own podcast. Demographics I've been told by jury consultants is basically garbage. Now, I do tend to overstate things to make a point. So you can, I love the fact that you don't, so you can always hold me in check. But generally, you walk into court, you know, Republicans or Democrats or African Americans or white, and that's kind of a determining factor where you're going to lean, right? Not at all. It's always about life experiences and attitudes. Let me give you a little example. I'm old enough to remember the O.J. Simpson criminal trial that was tried down in Los Angeles, in downtown Los Angeles. And much of that jury, I can't remember how many, was African American. And so when O.J. was found not guilty, many people in the trial sphere said, oh, this is a race thing. Well, when you actually studied that jury, what you found is that most of the jurors had bad experiences with LAPD. They did not trust LAPD. So at the end of the day, that was a case where you had people with life experiences who didn't trust the police and were open to a theory that maybe the police manufactured evidence because their own life experience backed that up.
Absolutely. I love that example. It's one of my favorite. And it's true. I mean, look, we, along with Valerie Hans at Cornell and Lee Ross at Stanford.
Spell her last name if people.
But. Yeah, it's H-A-N-S. Valerie Hans is a wonderful person, a good friend, and I think the most prolific jury researcher currently in the academic world. Jessica Salerno, who just went to Cornell, who's also a friend and a wonderful jury researcher. Lee Ross, who was at Stanford and was just a social scientist, but a brilliant one. Not specific to the law. I had the opportunity to publish with the three of them, and we studied 2,000 jurors. And what we were looking for is, how do you predict bias in jury behavior? And what we found is that these demographic characteristics had almost no predictive value. What had predictive value was general views about lawsuits and the court system. Because of course, if you spent 20 years saying that lawsuits are evil and wrong and ruin the world, that will influence your view of civil lawsuits. And if you've spent 20 years saying, I hate companies and I want everybody who sues them to win, that will also influence your view. And then specific questions about the case. So if it's a medical malpractice case, asking jurors, have you ever had a doctor save your life or the life of a loved one? If they say yes, they'll often tell you, and I can't imagine returning a verdict against a doctor because I just think what they do is too important. Well, that's an honest statement by a juror. And that might mean they have a deeply held belief that doesn't make them right for that case. That's okay. That's a lot better than finding out they're a woman or they're black or they're rich or they're whatever.
Yeah, 100%. John, I could talk to you all day long. I just am fascinated by this stuff. Before I let you go, any final words of wisdom to our audience that you want to share?
Well, I mean, this is a self-serving thing, so I'll admit it. But I will tell you, I'm really happy to be talking with you because I think as a young lawyer, the way we made decisions about who to pick for selection, how much to ask for in damages, or whether to propose a response if you're a defense attorney to damages, which order of witnesses, or whether our client was credible or not, or whether we should accept fault or not, was something that we workshopped. We maybe did a focus group. We walked down the hall and talked to another lawyer. We batted around with our family, and those were good things. But I do think we're in a place now where we can, instead of guessing for those things, we can know that those are actually empirical questions with answers. And I'm encouraged by that because I think the justice system gets better when both sides make better decisions for their client. And cases are decided on the best evidence we can put in front of jurors in the best way we can. So if you're a young lawyer, I would say find ways to continue to hone the craft of being a lawyer because it matters. Continue to learn how to get evidence in and all the rules of evidence. Continue to think about how you visually present things so that people retain them and learn them. But also maybe build into your toolkit the idea that we don't need to guess at most questions and cases, that we can, through a variety of ways, not just dealing with me, lots of ways, infuse some science into our decision making, and in doing so, represent our client at the highest level possible.
Fantastic. And trial, in my view, is always going to be an art. But thank you, John Campbell, for bringing more science into our profession. John Campbell, thank you for being a guest on Verdict Academy. Really appreciate you.
Thanks for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you for listening to Verdict Academy. If today's insights resonated with you, please subscribe and share with colleagues. In a world where we see each other less, learning from experienced trial lawyers matters now more than ever. Join us next time. Produced and powered by LawPods.